Welcome to Real World Theology, episode 54. On this episode of the podcast, we are going to talk about Jupiter Ascending. Oddly enough, Jupiter Ascending is probably already out of the box office competition by the time this episode will go up, which is slightly sad. And to help me talk about why that's sad is Josh Crabb from Real World Theology and Elijah Davidson from Real Spirituality, which, if you haven't caught before, is a really, really great podcast. So we have a chance to talk about what we really like about what the Wachowskis have done in some of their films, you know, what we've come to love, what we've come to kind of hate, if we would use a word that strong. But we admire lots of the things they've done and kind of how lots of their films end up having a mixed bag of Wachowski theology. But in this particular film, we get to talk about the value of life, identity, and fulfillment. And in this particular case, why it's okay to sometimes just have fun during a film. So here it is, episode 54, Jupiter Ascending, and Choose Your Own Theology. Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture, and to encourage viewers to recognize that entertainment is not mindless.
No, I'm kidding.
Father of the Year Award. Well, one of the reasons that I was excited to have you back on, Elijah, is because, one, I rarely get people out of nowhere who send me an email asking to be on a show or asking to be on an episode about a movie that doesn't come out for like another month or something, you know, unless it's like Avengers or like, you know, Star Wars. Everyone wants to be on Avengers. Everyone wants to be on Star Wars. And you were like, hey, I'm just putting this out there. I will totally talk about Jupiter Ascending. And I was like, yes.
Yeah,
and it wasn't just because of that you volunteered, but you volunteered because, and I'm going to say Wachowskis. Are you? Mm-hmm. Are we doing Wachowskis? Not Wachowskis.
Wachowskis. Yeah,
Wachowskis. Okay, Wachowskis.
Yeah.
Because you like their films, unlike almost everyone else.
I basically like their films. I think their films are pretty interesting. They're worth talking about. Put it that way. I like some of them a lot, and then I think the rest of them are really interesting. Yeah.
So, I mean, are there any Wachowski films that you don't like?
I guess, I mean, I got to be honest about the fact that those second and third Matrix movies aren't that good. Mm-hmm. But I still think they're super interesting. I love Speed Racer. Of course, the first Matrix movie is great. Cloud Atlas has some moments that are better than most other moments in most other movies. Mm-hmm.
But is that like a law of attrition, though? Is that like the movie was like 12 hours long, so...
So they're bound to hit something good, you know?
You throw enough stuff at the wall, right?
Yeah, they got Tickford helping them, too, so that always makes for a good film. Or an interesting film, at least. I don't know, I think that they're... You know, they always have all this like weird philosophical stuff in their films. Mm-hmm. Like even a movie like Speed Racer, which is like a live-action cartoon. I mean, it's like the dorkiest thing in the world, but... There's this diatribe in the middle like, about how terrible capitalism is, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, they can't get away from that stuff. And so I find it pretty interesting. And I also think that their philosophical leanings play out in their plots, too.
Yeah.
And in their story worlds, maybe as much as their plot, their setting as much as their anything else. Just they're super interesting. I like them. I always enjoyed their films. And then speaking of old podcasts, I did an episode – on our podcast a while back that was, ostensibly it was on Divergent, which we hated, but we used it to talk about young adult YA adaptations of a certain kind of book. But we ended up talking about Cloud Atlas mostly, which wasn't really a YA adaptation at all, but we just wanted to. Andrew Neil, AC Neil and I talked about it. And we kind of got at the heart of the Wachowski eschatology on that episode, and it made me really appreciate their films more, even if I don't agree with them. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so it's fun to see how that plays out in their films, I think.
Well, I know you're saying that you've already gotten to the heart of it, but I'm probably going to make you get to the heart of it again.
No, absolutely. Yeah, I'll talk about it. And it's even more, like in Jupiter Ascending, it's even more, you know, at the fore than it was in Cloud Atlas. So, yeah.
Well, I'm just glad that there is someone out there who, or at least it sounds like, loves Speed Racer as much as I do.
No, that's the best movie. I love that thing.
Every time I watch that, it's like watching it for the first time. Mm-hmm. It's amazing to me. And I hate to oversell it because I fear out of almost anyhow, you never want to give someone like something that you love and mm-hmm. have them tell you that they don't love it as much as you do. I'm almost like, I will tell people like, oh yeah, go watch The Matrix, go watch Gladiator, go, you know, you'll love these movies. But I'm almost afraid to give them Speed Racer because if they tell me they don't love it, mm-hmm. it might break my heart.
Yeah. No, I get that. Yeah.
So Josh, like, where do you land on Wachowski love?
Where do I land? Well, I mean, you know, obviously, like, I remember when The Matrix came out and it was like, you know, everybody collectively crapped their pants when that movie came out. And, you know, I think that you joked around about this on the Movie Bite podcast that, like, everybody talks about, you know, how everybody thinks that The Matrix is about their religion. And that's so true, you know, how they were kind of borrowing from everything. But, you know, like Elijah said, I find everything that they do to be incredibly interesting, you know, but and just fascinatingly, what's the right word? Like, artistic and beautiful at the same time. Mm-hmm. Like, everything they do is really, really interesting, even if it doesn't land the way that it should all the time. I mean, I even think, like, you know, they didn't direct, but they wrote V for Vendetta, which is a great mm-hmm. movie. Mm-hmm. You know, and so they've got these incredible ideas and these incredible things to say. And I don't think that we can, you know, even though people would be like, ah, you know, the Wachowskis are, you know, washed up and they can't make anything good anymore. And but I just don't see that in the movies that they make. So, you know, like, my love doesn't, like, ooze and gush, but, like, I want to see what they make, you know, and they're obviously filmmakers that get attention, and they get my attention when they come out with something. So, I mean, that's why I wanted to see this movie more than anything over the, you know, the winter doldrums of movie going in January and February. So I was really looking forward to this. It was kind of a bummer when they didn't have it in the summertime, but I mean, I guess they didn't think it was ready yet.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, that's interesting too, because I think it may have done better right there at the end of the summer when people were still in movie going mode. But I've noticed that August in general has been there's usually one good movie, mm-hmm. and everything mm-hmm. else is like blockbustery, but usually like very Hercules and
yeah.
type thing, where the movies that you're really going to remember from the summer tend to come out like in May and to a lesser extent June, and then it just kind of goes downhill like July and August, with a couple exceptions,
right?
Yeah, with the studios releasing fewer kind of blockbusters, they put them off the front of the summer so they can make more money on them over the course of the summer, hopefully. Mm-hmm. It's kind of their mm-hmm. idea. Yeah, then you get nothing in the early fall.
Yeah, you got nothing. What I've liked, and I think we talked about this on another episode, is that it seems like they're starting to finally realize that they're coming out with so many movies that they've got all these chunks of time where people are begging for just one good thing to go see. Mm-hmm. You know, they're not going to the movie theaters like in droves every weekend, but if you can toss something out there during a dead time and it can pick up most of your moviegoers for 2 or 3 weeks, you'll make the money that you would have in one weekend during the summer or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why, you know, October seems to be a pretty solid award movie month now. You know, just really mm-hmm. good films that aren't indie films, and they're not blockbusters, but they're just really good films. Now people are picking on, the January, February. Usually there's one good action film or something fun that, mm-hmm. that makes a decent amount of money. I mean, one of the reasons we didn't review the Lego movie last year is because, like, I was like, well, it came out, like, in late February,
I think.
Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, obviously they think it's going to be terrible, so no reason to go see it.
Yeah.
And then, you know, it ends up being one of the probably one of the best films of the year.
Yeah, I love February, March releases because usually they're movies that are they're weird. Like there's something about them. Like you can watch the movie like, oh, this is almost like a summer blockbuster, but there's something strange about it.
Mm-hmm.
And they knew that, and so they put it out here instead of putting it out in the summer. In the midst of everything else it looks like or whatever. Sometimes it means the movie's not very good, but sometimes it means it's kind of fun, like the Lego movie. So, yeah.
No, I think that's a great observation because I think two of the movies that I've seen this month that I enjoyed were Jupiter Ascending and Kingsman.
Mm-hmm.
And both, you're right, like they're something that you kind of get, but they just have a twist on it that makes it a little bit odd.
Yeah.
You know, lots of people said about Kingsman, you know, like this is going to, it's going to be something that you're probably used to seeing, kind of like a spoof satire of the James Bond genre, but it's all British people. Will American audiences really catch on to like a movie that has British people in it that actually don't try or aren't doing American accents, you know, because we're already used to seeing British people in everything. We just don't know. Cause
yeah.
Well,
sometimes they whisper and shout a lot.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. I'm so excited to talk about Eddie Redmayne.
They create life for those British people. It's amazing.
gosh. So, okay, so Jupiter Ascending. Jupiter Ascending, as we've talked about, was not only directed by Andy and Lana Wachowski, but it was written by them. So they basically had full creative, carte blanche?
Mm-hmm.
Or they had full artistic Cate Blanchett of of what was going on. And we had a fairly solid cast of, you know, not typically people who are known for their dramatic poise, but popular people, Mila Kunis, Channing Tatum, Sean Bean, Eddie Redmayne. So it's not like this was devoid of talent either. And in general, I had a hard time finding a good synopsis, but I guess with the reaction that lots of people had to the understanding what was actually going on in this film, I guess maybe that's why it was so hard to get a synopsis for it. So I'm assuming that most people have seen it, but if you are listening and you haven't, it's about a young, seemingly insignificant house cleaner. She's informed that she is the reincarnation of a queen of a powerful intergalactic family. This complicates things for her and for the intergalactic politics that she is thrown into the middle of. And that's about as spoiler-free as I can do a plot thing, though we're just going to spoil everything here in a second anyway.
that synopsis doesn't include things like a half dog, half man,
exactly.
Protectors, and Sean Bean is part B. So,
which that's one of the reasons I really liked your review because I was like, you're like, do you understand that Sean Bean is part B?
Yeah.
Like, I just want that. I want that to be out there. Well, okay. So
the best thing in the world.
Wait, we're skipping way ahead, Elijah, to our favorite moments. I need you to back off the favorite moments.
All right. Sorry.
Well, okay. We'll do this, Elijah. What? We've already talked about the eschatology kind of the Wachowskis in general, but what about Jupiter Ascending really stuck with you when you left the theater?
The other thing that I feel about the Wachowskis, I always feel this kind of protective kind of feeling toward the Wachowskis, because I feel like they're just big kids, like just having fun, you know, so many movies feel like they're made for adolescents. Since Star Wars, really, but for a long time. And the Wachowskis, I thought they were making movies for, like, little kids. But not little kids because they're incredibly violent at the same time, you know? But, like, they're little kids, like, playing with their stuff, which I think is really, really cool. And so, like, my feeling leaving the theater was that was a riot, you know? Like, that was just crazy fun is what it was more than anything else. And like, they have all their philosophy stuff in there, but at the core of it, it's just a lot of fun is what it is. Yeah. Sean Bean is part B. Like, how could a movie where that is true, like, not just be supposed to be fun, you know?
I say this as, like, the ultimate spoiler for this movie, so we can go ahead and get, you know, massive spoilers out of the way.
Mm-hmm.
Awesome.
Sean Bean doesn't die. How is that possible? He's in a movie where he does not die.
I know. Yeah.
I actually left the theater and was like, did he die? like I'm sure he did, right? Because he has to.
Mm-hmm. It's like contractual.
Yeah.
Okay, so,
well, actually,
so
it's like a rider. Yeah. Like Led Zeppelin had like all those things they needed in their riders, or you know, Jack White needs his guacamole. Like Sean Bean has riders in his movie contracts. I have to die, guys. All right.
Yeah. He just does not want to be in a sequel. That's got to be what it is. Like, Sean Bean has a no sequel clause, promptly.
He just wants to keep his schedule open, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
I can understand that.
My only like disappointment with the film was that we never got to see Sean Bean with his wings, like get his bee wings back and fly around, because that would have been just sublime. But we didn't get that. But I just thought it was so much fun. That's what I thought. The movie is just so much fun, you know, and just having a good time. Go have a good time.
Yeah, yeah. I'd agree with that, Josh. Besides, you know, the revelation of Sean Bean, what stuck with you when you left the theater?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of got the same thing. And like something I've always really liked about the Wachowskis is the fact that like the world that they create is just so vivid and so incredible. I think like that's what really stuck with me in the review is I kind of – you know, I said that they're sort of the spiritual and artistic, you know, heir apparents to like George Lucas or something like that. Like I got this really like episode, like the prequel trilogy vibe from them. And it was like very much like costumey and bright and vivid, which I thought was really, really cool. You know, I mean, and it's in stark contrast to something like The Matrix, which was very, you know, gray and didn't have that. All of that color and everything. And that's just something that's really, really great about their films is that it was, you know, something that I just couldn't put down is that even though it's not even close to my favorite Wachowski movie, that it was just, again, it was fun. You know, I liked how you described that, Elijah, that it almost felt like a kid playing with his toys, you know, yeah. And that's kind of the different elements is it felt like you grab like, oh, wouldn't it be cool if this guy was part B, and wouldn't it be cool if this guy was this, and like, wouldn't it be cool if this and that, and like, yeah, let's do that, and like,
anti-gravity roller skates, yeah,
and that's like something that a kid could do. They put on their roller skates and pretend they're, you know, they're skating around Chicago, and so that's something that's really fun, and I definitely think that hits at the heart of who the Wachowskis are. They definitely are like that. They're very much like you can tell that they work together and they bounce ideas off each other and they're very excited about the ideas that they come up with. There's no sense of like sort of a jadedness to their ideas at all. Like it's very much just like this is awesome and it needs to go on the screen. You know, I think I saw an interview where they said that basically they wanted to do a little bit more than what they did in the movie, but they said that it was going to cost them way too much. And so they had to basically cut. They were like, it was going to be awesome, but we had to cut it because it would have made the budget like $270 million. So, you know, that it's that kind of thing where it's just like they have those ideas and that kind of hits at the heart of who like I can be like think big and worry about if it'll cost too much money later. And that's kind of what I get from their movies, and that's what was really fun about it. So, yeah.
No, I would, like I said, I'm on the same page with you guys, and I didn't actually know how everyone would come out on this film. I figured that Elijah, even if you didn't enjoy it a lot, you would probably be sympathetic to its cause.
Yeah.
But I'm glad you thought it was a lot of fun. I had people asking me after I saw it, basically like, was it any good? And I was like, okay, so that's a hard question to answer.
Yeah,
you know, one, because I don't like to use bad and good if I can help it. Because I think there are parts of every movie that are worth discussing. And you know, and then, you know, different strokes for different folks. So, but I kept using the word entertained.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I was never really bored in this movie, even though some of the dialogue and some of the scenes should have been really boring. It was like I just left and I was like, you know what? It's not going to win an Oscar. Mm-hmm. Oh, well, I guess it might for production design or something wacky like that. But like it wasn't, you know, it wasn't a great movie, but I never wasn't entertained by it. Mm-hmm. And then I started thinking back. I was like, you know what? We've kind of, I feel like in the sci-fi, especially sci-fi fantasy, like this fits the sci-fi fantasy great because people are pigeonholing this as sci-fi. And I think in the sci-fi genre, we've kind of been fairly spoiled lately with things like Edge of Tomorrow and Elysium and Interstellar. Like, even if these films like weren't the greatest films in the world, they really lean heavily like on the science behind it. It's not it doesn't try to leave a lot of things unexplained. It doesn't pass by lots of stuff. It kind of says, this is the way things are, and this is how it's scientifically going to get there, and we need to explain it, and you're used to that happening. But people are forgetting that sci-fi fantasy just says, this thing exists because it does. Don't think about it. It's just cool.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's room for that. And it made me think of especially lots of sci-fi fantasy movies I saw like in the 90s and stuff, where it was just like, this is cool, you're gonna buy the toy and it's awesome. And I love what you're saying, Elijah, because I can imagine, even though the movie itself is violent and has lots of violence in it, I feel like if you were, you know, sitting by your kid's bedside and you were just making up a story, you could tell them almost the entire story of Jupiter Ascending. And without visually seeing lots of the graphic violence, you could describe almost everything that happens. And they'd be like, oh, and what happens next, Dad? You know, like you, they would be on the edge of their seat the entire time. And I love that. I love that about the sci-fi fantasy genre. And even though, again, it's not the greatest movie, I mean, it's not even the best movie I've seen already this year. And I've only seen like 3 movies this year. Mm-hmm. So, but that doesn't mean that I wasn't entertained. And I think that's completely valid.
Yeah. Well, here's a question I have. Like, why do we? Like, I think the kind of the antecedent or whatever to like this Jupiter Ascending is stuff like Flash Gordon and the mm-hmm. Those kind of like big space operatic like sequel based like, you know, you used to like they used to watch like come back next week for part 2 of Flash Gordon to the Rescue or whatever, those kind of things. You know, it's that kind of thing. It's the kind of thing that gave us Star Wars and Indiana Jones, because those are the things that Lucas and Spielberg loved so made these bigger movies. And now we expect, for some reason, we humans expect those movies to like change our lives instead of them just being fun, it seems. And like, we don't, like John Carter, we can't like let John Carter just be fun. You know, it's got to be serious and real and like, yeah, change us.
Well, I mean, this is why I don't understand, like, anyone who is a current fan of things like Doctor Who.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Doctor Who is sci-fi fantasy, and, like, they don't explain half the things that happen in the show. You're just expected to be like, okay. But it happens in space, and there's cool, and there's time travel. But you don't over-question it. You just enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
And occasionally you get touching moments, and occasionally you get sad moments, but most of the time it's fun and flighty and just sparks imagination. And this entire movie was just like one big spark to imagination. I was like, I've never thought about Jupiter like this. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just visually awesome. And I don't think there's a problem with that. So, Elijah, one of the things... And this, like I said, could get to you comparing it to some of their previous films. One of the things I really liked from your particular review of Jupiter Ascending is talking about how, even though this film's tons of fun, mm-hmm. and we were all entertained by it, it's not that the Wachowskis are devoid of throwing different philosophies and spiritualities in there. And you even said... In this particular film, power is meaningful only when it's used to care for others. Mothers should be cherished. Fathers should be revered. Romance is based on mutual respect. And it might not be a bad idea to have a woman in charge of things for a while. Like, all these ideas are just kind of thrown out there.
Yeah.
and I don't. I would say that all those are in there and probably more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so are these the kind of things that you see in their films in the past, too?
Yeah, I think that's usually there. You know, those things are usually there, and I think actually that's kind of those kind of things, and the way that those things are presented in their movies, is what makes people think that their movies are supposed to be taken seriously, and not for fun. Because I mean, if I were to argue the other side of the review, you know, of mm-hmm. this review of the film, and say, yeah, it's trying to be fun, but you know, there's like incestuous relationships and. These kind of people are like literally being grown to be the fodder of other people, you know, like mm-hmm. there's like all this really disturbing stuff going on too. And I think that's where the Wachowskis kind of lose their audiences a lot of times, where they're having fun. Sean Bean is part B, but this guy wants to marry his mom, you know, like stuff like that. Kind of gets pretty disturbing sometime in their films. But from that other stuff, you kind of get these really interesting ideas about the kind of world the Wachowskis wish existed. That's super interesting. And I think it confounds people a lot of times. I think that's why the Matrix sequels, people don't tend to like them very much. Because the ending of the third Matrix movie is incredibly frustrating. Mm-hmm. Because you've watched like 9 hours of movie now, and you're expecting someone to win and someone to lose. And at the end of the Matrix, spoilers ahoy, you have two of the programs sitting on a bench in this newly created world saying, what do we do now? And they say, I don't know. We've never been here before. We got to figure it out. Like, what is peace going to look like in this place where we refuse to kill each other anymore? And people just aren't prepared for that kind of an ending, I don't think. And for that kind of vision of what the world could be. And I think it just frustrates people. Yeah.
Well, I think that's something we talked about with Birdman too, the frustration people have with open ended endings where it's not like this is the answer. Yeah. They're just like, these are ideas. And I think it's one of the reasons why lots of people, when they look back at a movie like The Matrix, they all see, like Josh said earlier, everyone sees their own religion in it.
Mm-hmm.
Because the Wachowskis are good at throwing tons of ideas and, like I said, things that sound very spiritual or philosophical out there. But then they never typically, and you guys can, you know, debate this part, I don't really think they typically ever throw any concrete answers out there.
Mm. Yeah. I don't know if there's much to debate. That seems pretty true.
Yeah.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Like, I mean, what do you take away from a Wachowski film? Or what do you take away from Jupiter Ascending?
Oh, man.
Besides that it was fun.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, isn't that, I don't know, is that sad or is that good? I mean, it was fun. I don't think that there was necessarily a ton to take away. I liked some of the elements that didn't really hit. Like, I feel like when they got serious, like you guys were just saying, that they didn't really hit with the sort of impact. I almost felt like adding all of those weird elements, like, you know, just kind of like casual incest and like all these genetic things and everything, it led to a little bit of like genre confusion. And I guess that was my biggest problem with the movie, is it's like, if you're going to be serious about some serious things, then be somewhat serious.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or just be fun and be like
Sean Bean. Be like Sean Bean.
Yeah, well, be more like Star Wars. Like, Star Wars mm-hmm. has some things to say, but it's more of like a meta narrative understanding of like the human condition. Whereas like this movie has some very specific things to say. You know, like it. You know, I don't know, because I would say that kind of I'm thinking in the realm of like Snowpiercer, but Snowpiercer had its fun elements as well. And, you know, that's a movie that's led to a lot of debate, too. Like, some people think it's the stupidest movie ever. Like, you know, so I recently had some people that were like, oh, have you seen Snowpiercer? I was like, yeah, it was totally awesome. And like, oh, we hated it. And I was like,
what? And you're like, I'm not your friend anymore.
Yeah.
well, how about this? So when you're talking about like them not really pausing, what I call pause for effect.
Yeah.
Like, I remember something that I heard in the middle of the film and I was like, what? We need to stop and talk about that. Mm-hmm. And I felt like they just kept going. And that was when Eddie Redmayne or Balaam says, you know, some lives will always matter more than others. And then he probably screams something right after it, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh my gosh. Like, so are they having the bad guy say that some lives will always matter more than others to prove that that's not what they believe? Huh. Or are we supposed to get on board with that? Or is that just like a truth that we're supposed to deal with?
Right.
Well, I mean, I think that that specific question, I mean, I think the Wachowskis always propose a radical equality. Mm-hmm. among all humans, a radical equality among all humans. So when a bad guy says some people matter more than others, you're not supposed to take that as gospel truth. You know, like that's wrong in the Wachowskis' world. I think.
Well, I would probably agree, and I think it's one of those great things that, you know, lots of people's philosophies or worldviews can grab onto. I mean, at the end of the day, like as Christians, like we believe that a poor carpenter from Nazareth, of all places, you know, could be the savior of the world. Mm-hmm. So we're fine with like people from, you know, house cleaning circumstances being risen to royalty. Mm-hmm. And so I'm like, okay, so there's a little bit of Christian ideology in there. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, that we have things like reincarnation, like, oh, you know, like when you die, your whatever's go into the universe and sometimes the universe sends them back. I'm like, what does that mean?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it's really important to understand with the Wachowskis that they're, like you said, people can grab onto the Matrix and stuff like this in a thousand ways from different religions or whatever, because they're borrowing all these ideas or whatever. Really, you know, their idea of the universe is not that there is anything spiritual about it. Like, it is a very humanistic picture of what the universe is. So it's not reincarnation. It's the random. The random chance alignment of genes that made her exactly like the other person, you know? It's not, there's nothing fated about it. The closest they ever come to fate is in Cloud Atlas, or Destiny or anything. And with that birthmark that passes through, and that wasn't even their idea. That was something that came from the source material. And it's downplayed a lot in their film from what it is in the original novel. It's very human. I mean, their world. I mean, their view is very human. That's the epitome of all that is. The good side of that is this. I mean, like I wrote here, like humans are valued. People are valued not because of what they look like or what they do, just because of the fact that they are humans capable of love. You know, that is the core of. I think the core of what the Wachowskis believe. And it makes sense when you think about that one of these siblings is a transgendered woman. Mm-hmm. who has adopted a very unconventional lifestyle. And you watch these films and you think these two siblings have probably always felt a little bit on the outside. Mm-hmm. Of whatever society they were in. They've probably always been made fun of for their proclivities, for their interests, the people that they are. Mm-hmm. And they are wishing for a world where people were valued and loved, not based on anything other than the fact that they're human. Humans capable of love. And like, I don't agree with this non-spiritual reality that is like at the core of all their films or whatever. Mm-hmm. But I do really love that tenacious, insistent value of all people.
Well, that's what I would say too. I watching their movies, I always wonder if I can ever figure out what they really believe. Mm-hmm. And I feel like watching their movies, I always come away with a little bit of ambiguity, but then, you know, hearing their real life stories, I'm like, yeah, they're the outsider and they want people just to get along.
Yeah.
They want people to be like, you know, be cool to others and just be cool in general. Mm-hmm. They have a very the dude philosophy, you know?
Yeah.
You know, like, be cool, man.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's like, and it's like I said, it does seem very human-centric and I guess probably very humanistic, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
To where it's like, you know, be cool to your surroundings, appreciate what you have, and when it comes to what you're supposed to do, just if there's something you're interested in, pursue it and don't let things stop you.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think if there's a little, especially since they wrote it along with directing it, I see them in each character somehow. Yeah. You know, they're Jupiter because they want to believe that they're more than, like, their identity doesn't just lie in their occupation.
Mm-hmm.
They're Cain because, you know, at one point, Sean Bean's character Stinger like tells him, "You've been searching for one thing your whole life, and she's down there." Basically, like this, like if you've been searching for something or you have a passion for something, why would you let anything get in between you and that thing?
Mm-hmm.
So very self-fulfillment kind of don't let anything stand in your way. Even though I think the irony to those philosophies lies in the fact that sometimes recklessly pursuing what you are passionate about sometimes means you have to not be cool to others.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, you gotta recklessly pursue love. That's kind of their thing. Mm-hmm. Not just anything, but love is the thing you have to pursue above all else. It's just like Interstellar, you know?
I think lots of people would be very mad that you said that.
Well, it is. I mean, the underlying philosophy is just like Interstellar. It's just, I mean, the movie itself is not, of course, but the philosophy is. Like, it's what's the bad guy in this movie, ultimately? I mean, you got the siblings who are, like, fighting over who gets control of the Earth, but the real overarching bad guy is time. Time is the only resource, right? That's what the sister says at one point. Because time is the one thing that, as smart as we are, no matter what our technology allows us to live, eventually we're going to die. Like, mm-hmm. we can't get over time. And just like in Interstellar, like time is the big bad guy in Interstellar that has to find a way around. And the way around it is love, of course. Because that is the most mysterious, like love is the most mysterious force in that kind of human only, materialist is what they call Nolan, worldview, you know? Like I hate that word worldview technically, but I try not to use it. But because I don't think anyone has a concise worldview. Even as I reduce the Wachowskis and Nolan down to a single worldview. Sorry.
I'm fine with you exploring that space.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, you know, like there's, that's it. You know, love is the most mysterious thing in that. And love is the thing that seems to transcend whatever other boundaries there seem to be, especially the boundary of time. Yeah, I mean, I think the Wachowskis and Christopher Nolan will probably have a great lunch together, you know, just talking about the fact that they believe the same thing, you know, and play it out differently in their films. Excuse me.
Yeah. Well, it's really interesting that in science, well, I say science fiction, but science fiction fantasy, any kind of science fiction based film, it usually sticks with me this concept that love is usually a big part, even though love can almost never be explained.
Mm-hmm.
And there's lots of ways and traditions and religions that explain love, but they reject them simply because they have the word religion attached to them. Even though usually those explanations, like I said, don't negate science to many degrees, but they actually work in cooperation, but just explain this piece they don't understand.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really odd taking that and going to the next step, that if they're okay with love, because it seems like science fiction authors and storytellers give a pass to love for some reason, even though love is often irrational and it makes people make poor choices. And usually most of the philosophies of these people who are exceedingly pro-science, which, I mean, I'm a big fan of science, but like they don't make an exception for anything else except for love in their, like I said, their philosophy of always make the most rational choice. It doesn't make rational sense to, you know, punch someone and take their lunch money, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But they always, like I said, for some reason, love transcends that. And I would just wonder how they reconcile that, or if they even stop to think about it, or they're just like, well, it's just love. It's a mystery. We're going to try to science it away at some point.
Well, you know, that's what Interstellar did. You know,
yeah.
It literally scienced it away. It said love is a dimension we don't understand yet, but one day we will, you know. It simplified it down to that, to another measurement we can make of the universe. Yeah.
Huh. So with the reoccurring themes that we see in this film, that we've seen in other Wachowski films, I've seen one criticism leveled against this film, and that it's basically just The Matrix in space. Is that unfair?
No, I mean, it's kind of what it is.
Josh,
really?
It's Sean Bean is part B.
Really? I don't know about that. I don't know if that's necessarily an accurate description of this movie. It seems so much different than The Matrix.
Okay, well, I'm going to do this, and then Josh, I want you to prepare yourself for defense.
Okay.
Okay? So, The Matrix, or well, actually, I'm going to describe one film, and you can tell me which film I'm describing.
Okay.
There is a person living their life, and it's a fairly mundane existence, and then one day, someone shows up, a harbinger or something, shows up, and tells them that their existence is completely opposite of what they thought it was. And furthermore, that they're probably the key to saving humanity as they know it. How am I doing so far?
And you can add that humanity only exists to be a, how are we going to put it?
Like as a fuel source?
A fuel source.
Yeah.
For a more evolved form of life.
Hmm.
Okay, so
you can add that to it. Yeah.
So there's like a, you know, a how we get to the ending that changes a little bit, but go, Josh.
What do you mean go?
Go. what?
That all sounds really great. The only thing that I would say that may be different is, like, I don't feel like the and maybe it's because like the person who, like, ultimately takes on all of the action and, like, knows how to do kung fu and everything like that is Neo in The Matrix, but, like, I don't really feel like Jupiter turns into, like, the Neo savior kind of character, I guess, if you want to put it that way. I felt like through a lot of this movie, she was, like, just the vessel of the story.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, Kane is really the dude who is, like, you know, the strong action-y type dude, and all these other things are happening all around her. It's almost like she is all this stuff is happening all around her, and she's just going along for the ride. Like, I don't really feel like she gets anywhere. I mean, ultimately, yeah, she's the one who takes out Balaam to a certain extent. But even that's still, Kane is helping with that too. And so it's, you know, the comparisons are definitely there. Sure, the story can be extremely similar, but I think that it's different in the fact that, like, it seems like Jupiter's on this journey, but she's not as an active a protagonist as Neo was.
I'll buy that.
Yeah, that's very true.
I think that's a really, really cool point in the fact that in The Matrix, we see Neo having to be a highly active participant,
mm-hmm.
because he needs to, he goes through this metamorphosis or this rebirth. Yeah, use some religious terminology.
Woo.
He goes through this rebirth and kind of steps into this new self. And then in that new self, he does something. Whereas Jupiter doesn't really have to change.
Right.
She's royalty because she is. Mm-hmm. Or she's the rebirth of this person because she is, not because she learns how to do some great trick.
And maybe that's the evolution of the Wachowskis' philosophical thinking. That might have something to do with it.
We should send them an email.
We probably should. Is this an evolution of your? Please respond.
I think it's one of the reasons why Jupiter Ascending is not as good as The Matrix.
Yeah.
Because it's a little bit confused on what kind of story it is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, is this a story about getting home, coming home again? You know, which is really kind of what Jupiter's arc is. It's you go off into the universe or into the world, and then the real journey is to realize back home is what you always wanted, kind of thing.
Right.
Or is it is it the Matrix, which is kind of this coming of age story for a character, a more straight Star Wars kind of thing.
Yeah, and it's I feel like it kind of lost that when they decided to go all like Terry Gilliam Brazil and even throw in a Terry Gilliam cameo in the movie. When they decided to go all Brazil on it and have this section of it where, you know, they're going through this whole process of proving that she's genetically the rebirth of this person. Mm-hmm. And it kind of loses its way in that sense. That's where I thought that there was that point in the movie. It was kind of like, this isn't going to be the same kind of movie as The Matrix. And I feel like that's where their influence is, where they're like, we really like Terry Gilliam, so let's make sure that we throw Terry Gilliam in here. So that might be the kid thing again, though. It was kind of like, wouldn't this be awesome? Yes, go for it.
Of course it would.
And then we got him, so we got to include the scene.
Right, exactly.
That scene is really funny. I've enjoyed reading all the reviews that say that that's the best scene in the movie. And... Mm-hmm. Which cracks me up, because I'm like, well, that's the scene that doesn't make the most sense within the rest of the movie. That's the movie you wish it was, reviewer who hates the Wachowskis, before you watch the movie. Not you, but the person I read. You know?
It was very agreed. Much, it was very much, you know, Gilliam and a little bit Matrix-esque. You know, it kind of had like a – it kind of like all of a sudden was like, we're switching to this sort of almost steampunk sort of look. And I mean, that might be people's favorite part, because apparently everyone likes steampunk. I don't know.
Well, it's the part that didn't feel like a Wachowski brother or Wachowski sibling movie, you know?
Right.
But I did think it was funny, though, like what that scene accomplishes philosophically. The idea that, because like you hear like, she's the queen of the earth. That's a huge thing. And then you find out it's just a matter of paperwork. Like, like prestige, authority doesn't really mean anything. It's just, did you get the right paper stamped, you know? It's like an undercutting of that idea, which is very Wachowski, that radical equality kind of thing.
That was what weird when she was going around. I was like, does no one care that she's like the queen now?
Yeah.
And everyone was like, don't care.
Yeah, doesn't matter.
You're just another cog in the wheel.
Right. Yeah, maybe that's the interesting thing, is it's like it's almost assumed in that section that there's like lots of other dynasties that, you know, own all this other stuff, or I don't know, maybe the Abrasaks. I almost said Abrasaks.
Abrasaks.
It's like the lost lost instrument in Kenny G's collection. But the Abrasaks, you know, they almost it hints at like they're just one industrialist family or something, like the Rockefellers. And, you know, because they say something about that. I think they say that they're a very important family, but it doesn't say like they're the family.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And
there's one of many.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. And so it's kind of interesting how it. You kind of wish maybe that could have been explored, but maybe you don't, because it's better off not being explored, because it would have made the movie even worse.
I mean, the more you explain, the more and more you tell people, like, this is real, not this is fantasy.
It's like the failure of almost every YA novel adaptation movie that came out last year, you know, except for the one that's already made it to the third part.
Yeah.
And, which I thought was really interesting too, because they did not deny that they were going for almost a YA novel feel to their book, to their movie.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and that's kind of what you get. You get a Jupiter who's very much a YA type character. And she goes on this journey, and it's almost, but the only, like I said, the only thing I think that is missing is she doesn't become, you know, like she doesn't become Katniss or anything like that. She doesn't rise up and become this, you know, fighter who can fight back and everything. She kind of lets Kane do the fighting.
But at the end, she does get to go on a little flight around the city with Eagle Wing Channing Tatum.
She does.
So, you know, as my wife said, that's just every girl's dream. So
nice. Which is really interesting too, because I thought that like a lot of the imagery that they were having is they were almost explaining why we might think as human beings, why we might think in a, like a gods and goddesses or like God and angels and things like that mentality, but just the way that they were telling the story. Cause I felt like, you know, when Kane unfurled his wings, I was like, whoa, is this supposed to be like a direct, like angel sort of reference?
Yeah.
And you know how that the Abrasix family is kind of like gods and goddesses in control of, you know, all these different planets. And you know, Balaam lives on Jupiter, which is, you know, a major planet in the Greek and Roman mythology. And you know, the lizard men are kind of like fallen angels in a sense, that they're kind of like these dark winged creatures and everything. So I thought that was really interesting too. It's not really something explained. It just really piqued my interest from an artistic standpoint of what they were doing. So, and I really felt that strongly when he unfurled his wings at the end. It was kind of like, he looks like an angel, you know, like an archangel or something.
Yeah, he totally does. Yeah. I thought it was funny. You say that the one comment Real Spirituality got on Twitter about when I released this review or whatever was from some guy, I don't know who he is. it's kind of a troll comment or whatever. But the guy said, I said, how did I do the tweet? I said something like, Jupiter Ascending, I just quoted my review. Jupiter Ascending is an exciting film with a good heart, a smile on its face, and a sense of social responsibility. And this guy replied and said, not to mention a vehicle for a propaganda by the enemy for advancing the ancient alien astronaut theory. And I couldn't tell if he was being serious or not. And I think he was being serious. I think he actually thinks the movie is a vehicle of propaganda by the enemy for advancing the ancient alien astronaut theory.
Did he not put like a winky face?
No winky face. I think he's dead serious here.
No winky face.
Yeah.
Winky face would have been crucial.
I know, if he's being sarcastic. Yeah, but no, genuine there. But I can totally see how people could take it that way, though. Like, and be angry about that idea. You know, like I think you're right. I think the movie is, the story kind of suggests some of those, not suggests, but it uses some of that imagery and those ideas. Yeah.
Well, so let's take it this way. Like, someone who thinks a film, or okay, let's say people think this film is specifically saying that. It's the similar to me when someone takes one verse of the Bible and, you know, they take it drastically out of context and they say, this is what the entire Bible is about, or this is what all Christians believe. And it doesn't take it into context of either the surrounding scripture or the overarching narrative of the entire text. And so what we've talked about already on this show is, if you really think about what the Wachowskis believe, and what they've said in their other films and what the rest of this movie kind of portends, like, you're like, do we really think the Wachowskis are like, you know what, we're going to make a movie to talk about our very firm belief in the, you know, the pre-creation or outer alien creation of the Earth.
Alien astronaut theory.
Yeah. I mean, like, so do we really think, based on the other movies they've made, based on what other things happen in this film, that's what they're really pushing here?
Yeah. No.
Textually, I don't think so.
Yeah. They're not pushing it.
People are assuming that it's Battlefield Earth.
Exactly. Yep. That's what they're assuming.
Oh, well, okay, so there was something that was mentioned earlier that I didn't really think about until we just brought it up, about one of the differences between, like, this and The Matrix, even though, obviously, you know, there's some similarities. And I wonder if this could be a change in their philosophy, or just work for the story, or what. But in The Matrix, Neo, like, basically has to drastically change the world for it to be survivable. And one of the frustrating things for me at the end of Jupiter Ascending was not the message that I think they were trying to convey, but how they conveyed it. And that was that Jupiter doesn't say, like, the world, you know, Earth needs to change to survive. It's just like, you need to appreciate what you had before, and going on this journey allowed me to appreciate cleaning toilets. Whereas Neo's like, I don't appreciate working in an office. I don't appreciate being a cog in the wheel. I've got to, you know, drastically wake up what was going on. As opposed to, was it Cypher, who was like, just put me back in. I don't care. I don't want to know. And that, to me, like I said, it was frustrating at the end, because I don't necessarily think you can go and see that there are other life forms out there and be told that you're the queen bee, and then just go back to cleaning toilets. I feel like there's some kind of change there. Like, you know, maybe I don't understand the draw of Winged Channing Tatum, but Winged Channing Tatum doesn't seem like enough for me to not push my life forward a little bit. Mm-hmm. Did that was that weird for anybody else? Am I just...
No, I think you're right. Like I think it's that frustrating thing about like with Cypher though, or the end of the Matrix, where the vast majority of people are not aware of real reality, you know, and they're not going to be. That seems to be something the Wachowskis kind of believe, that there is some kind of,
like, they're more enlightened. Like
they're more enlightened, yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think that's also what ticks people off about their movies too, you know. But yeah, I think that's there in all their films. I don't agree with that, but I think that's there in all their films. Yeah. Hmm. Yeah. And that's kind of frustrating.
Well, let's start to wrap it up a little bit, because we're getting about that time. And we've admitted this wasn't a perfect movie. So there's probably plenty to harp on. And Elijah, I'll let you harp first. What was your least favorite moment, or your like the thing that made you say, "Come on, man"?
Oh goodness, there's so much in this movie that you can just say, "Kind of come on" about, because you know they throw a lot of things up there. I'll just go back to the a philosophical thing that I like to point out about their films. You know, the eschatology idea. You know, it's that thing that humans are the end all of everything, and that there's no hope beyond the continued evolution of humanity. And that eventually what we'll have to do is leave this place and go someplace else. I disagree very strongly with that. You know, I think that, I believe something very different, you know, that there is something beyond humanity, and, that our destiny is not out there somewhere. It's in taking care of this place, this earth, that the fate of this earth is tied up in the fate of people, and yeah, all that kind of stuff. So I don't agree with that. That's what I realized talking to AC about Cloud Atlas, because it kind of says the same thing. Hmm. And I think that's a very hopeless view of the future. And yeah, makes me a little bit sad. I wish that the Wachowskis could believe something more than they believe, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's fair. Josh?
Wow, is mine going to seem like totally lame compared to Elijah's?
I can go back. I can say something else. I also thought it was kind of ridiculous that we never got to see Sean Bean with wings. So that really disappointed me, because that's why I was there, really.
That's kind of like an overpromise, right? That's like, it is. He's a bee, and you're like, okay, show me.
I know. And show nothing. Stinker's wings.
No. It's in the sequel that we'll never see.
All right. Well, then I'll have two, and I'll work backwards from that to something a little bit more serious. But the whole Eddie Redmayne performance is just a one big come on. And I don't know what on earth that man was doing in this movie. But you remember like those old motivational posters where it has like the pelican swallowing a frog and the frog sticking its arms out and choking the pelican so it can't swallow it? I felt like that's what happened to Eddie Redmayne before every scene shot, is that they were just like, all right, swallow this and let it choke you while you talk.
And wait a minute, are we skipping forward to my favorite moments already?
So I think that previous podcast guest and film spotting guy Josh Larson said that it was like he just swallowed the carton of cigarettes.
Yeah.
Is I think how he put it. And it's just, it's so ridiculous. And he's like a baby that smoked a pack of cigarettes, and he's just as petulant as said baby during this movie. Cause you know, like he's given from like these quiet whispers, to these incredibly large yelling streaks where he just yells like mommy took away his toys. And it's just, it was not good. It was really strange. And I was really looking forward to Eddie Redmayne being in this movie. And it just felt like it was way too over the top performance. It was just like the scenery was just salted up, and he was chomping the snot out of that scenery.
And I think you mean Academy Award winner Eddie Redmayne.
It really takes the edge off of any criticism you have of somebody when they've already won an Academy Award. Oh, I'm sorry. Are you referring to the Oscar-winning actor Eddie Redmayne? Yeah, I'm sorry. All of my points are invalid.
Well, I say that was one of my favorite tweets all night. It's like when he won, the one of the tweets that went right out was like, obviously the Academy hasn't seen Jupiter Ascending yet or something like that.
Well, it's good. Usually you win an Oscar, then you make a terrible movie. That tends to be the kind of the pattern or whatever. He just got it out of the way before he won, you know? That was nice. Good. A terrible performance is just gone now. He can move on to something else.
Interesting.
Yeah. What else, Josh?
All right. Well, then the only other thing that I felt was like a come on moment was, you know, what I was touching on previously, where I felt like you could have had a lot stronger female character in Mila Kunis. And she has some good moments and she has some bad moments. But I think that it was just an overall come on that she it seems like the best times that she or the times that she was at her best was, I mean, and granted, she's, you know, funny. So her best moments were like when she was being comedic or kind of ridiculous. Like, I know a lot of people are really harping on that, you know, I love dogs line from, but it's actually not really that bad of a line.
Oh, it's so funny. I love that line. Yeah.
And it's like, it seems like something that someone who really is sort of like caught up in a being caught up in love with somebody, they would say those kind of things, like, yeah, to justify, like, when I was younger and not having been married for 9.5 years, if I was, you know, courting or dating or whatever my wife, whatever you Christians prefer,
you Christians
but, you know, whatever you prefer there, I would say something like that if it would kind of like think like, this could, you know, this could work.
Yeah. Your wife comes home or your girlfriend comes home and she's like, oh my gosh, I had a, you know, dog sit. And now I just smell like dogs. And, you know, Josh is like, I love dogs. I've always loved dogs.
Yeah. I love the double meaning of that line too, because she just said all the guys she likes turn out to be terrible, like just jerks and terrible guys. You know, because the other context with a dog is that guy's not worth anything. You know, I love dogs. Awesome. Like, that's my whole problem. And I've always loved you. Dogs. Yeah.
For sure. Oh, man. I think you just blew my mind a little bit. Oh, my gosh.
Nice.
So, okay. There's an understood eye roll moment for me in this film. And one of them is kind of Mila Kunis being underused. And I would have liked her to be more proactive. But at the same time, I realize, like, they're throwing so much at us, mm-hmm, that she basically is our stand-in. Like, she goes somewhere new. She goes, where am I? What's going on? Because that's exactly what I'm wondering the entire movie. So she goes somewhere else, and it's like, where am I at? What's going on? You know, who are you? What are you doing? So she basically is my stand-in. So I realize kind of, In this so many moving parts type of story, she is someone that I kind of need to make sure I have a general understanding of what's going on, but I wish it didn't have to be that way. So it's like my 50% least favorite part. And then the thing that really bothered me was after I left the theater, I did the cardinal sin of watching, like I said, a sci-fi fantasy movie. And that's like, I overthought the plot. Huh. Mm. And I said, so if you can basically implant an entire planet with life, it means you can create life. It means that you can create little things that grow.
Yes. And Eddie Redmayne let us know he could create life.
Exactly.
Yes. Mm. Very forcefully.
So what that means to me is that you should just be able to grow a farm of people and harvest them, not let them grow up and, like, and then, I guess, do whatever for a million years before you try to make money off of them. And then I realized, oh, wait, it's the Matrix. It'd have been too obvious if they grew a farm of people in test tubes and then just harvested them that way in their really weird gel stuff. So I didn't understand And it, like I said, it wasn't explained, and I didn't really want it explained at the time. I just wanted to know that the Earth was in danger, and that we didn't want, you know, Balaam or whatever to have the planet, because that was bad. And that, like I said, at the time, it's all I needed. But then thinking about it, I was like, if he can just do this, what? And he's even got test tubes or whatever on his ship. Why don't you just grow them there? And do we have to, like, live some kind of existence for a million years before, like, we have the spark, the all spark, you know, the Optimus mm-hmm. Prime comes back for or whatever? Like, I don't understand.
Yeah.
So, I it was my own fault. So, my least favorite movie was my own fault because I shouldn't have thought about it. Yeah. So,
but, I did like that in The Matrix that was explained, you know? Like, in The Matrix, it was just the idea that you, there, it wasn't like humanity was sitting in those tubes forever. It was like a constant process of mm-hmm. growing and harvesting kind of thing. And they
just cut it off.
Yeah, they believed they were living in 1999. Yeah, no matter how long they had been there. I like mm-hmm. that in The Matrix. But you're right. Don't overthink it.
Just stop. Okay, so then Elijah, what did you really enjoy about this movie?
Oh, I love that first dogfight all around Chicago. With them, like, first they're like skating around, and then they steal the ship from one of the bad guys or whatever. That dogfight was amazing. Like, I one thing I love about the Wachowskis is that you always know where you are in the midst of an action scene. I never feel discombobulated, you know. Mm-hmm. I know where all the pieces are and what they're doing and what's going to happen, not next, but what just happened, I guess. Which, compared to something, so many of these action movies nowadays, I don't want to, well, Michael Bay is the worst of it, but there are others too, where you never know what's going on. Like, you literally can't follow the action. You just know loud things are hitting each other. And I just thought that dogfight was so much fun. And I don't know how in the world they shot that, because that wasn't a CGI Chicago. Like, something flew around Chicago to film that, and then they added in the CGI ships or whatever. Mm-hmm. And however they choreographed that, like, however they, you know, I planned it out beforehand. I don't know how in the world they did that. That was amazing. Like, I loved that dogfight scene. I would watch that 1,000 times. Hmm. I hope people making Star Wars right now watch that and take some cues from how well that was done and how real it all felt, even though we knew the ships weren't real, you know?
Yeah.
Well, we know that J.J. Abrams is pretty humble and likes to get input from other people, so that'll probably happen. Oh, sorry. Winky face.
Yeah.
Well, Elijah, they used a helicopter.
Yeah.
And they put up a unique rig and, like, did this all with, like, helicopters and stuff. So apparently it was, like, a lot of stunt rehearsal and a lot of other stuff like that. Uh-huh. But it was very unique. Like, they I read an interview that they did for it, and they said that it took them up until like a day or two before they did the shooting to get the FAA to actually approve them doing it. So yeah, it was they said it was pretty crazy, and it was a huge setup, but apparently that was like their big action shot that was pretty rad, and which I yeah. totally agree was awesome.
Oh, it's amazing. I wish more movies would do that kind of thing. Like, often you get those kind of scenes and they're just in space, it's all fake. You know, yeah. none of it's real. And this, like, that's real buildings. I mean, that's amazing. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, actually, some people said that scene was too long. And that was one of the criticisms.
I had to watch that for 2 hours.
Interesting. I was like, I thought it was longer than I expected a normal, like, action beat to be. But I did think it was pretty incredible looking. Mm-hmm. So it didn't really, I mean, I thought that was a fairly okay concession to make.
Well, just juxtapose that with that, like, Warhammer scene and just how much different they are. Like, the Warhammer scene is just, like, it's dumb.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't really fit, like, what's going on. And it just seemed like it gave Sean Bean something to do. And honestly, I thought that was going to be, like, Sean Bean's death moment.
Mm-hmm. I know.
Like, what the heck? What happened, man?
We gave you everything you needed to die.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so Josh, what was your favorite moment?
Oh, man, I don't know if I can pin it down to necessarily one favorite moment. I really enjoyed that action sequence as well. I really thought that was fantastic and really, really great. I think the thing that made this movie really enjoyable for me was the fact of just how detailed and how artistic the whole thing was. There was just a real beauty to the movie when it got into outer space that you kind of wish sometimes people would do more. Like, I think I mentioned in my review, like, there was very much minutia to their designs. And, like, there was, like, on Titus Abrasic's spaceship, there was a statue of him on the outside that, you know, gets decapitated during the Warhammer scene. And it was that whole idea of, like, you're thinking about it that much that you want to put all these intricate details into it just was really, like, just a favorite part of the whole movie in general. I just thought that was really, really fun and great. Yeah.
Well, no, I'd say for me, that's probably what did it for me as well. Like, I was just enjoying watching this film. Yeah. You mentioned earlier that, like, you know, like, the Matrix is all, like, blues and grays, you know, and yeah. Then well, we talked about Speed Racer, and it's just like it's a like watching a
scope.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, it's a it's so bright, right? Almost the entire time. And it's like, if those two films had a baby, it just seems like it might have been Jupiter Ascending. Mm. Because it was all these oranges and, you know, just very colorful colors, but like always tinted by like these shadows. And I just thought it was visually very engaging. I just love watching anytime one of the ships was in outer space. I was like people just don't typically think about ships moving the way those ships moved. And that was neat to me. I loved every time they went like into Jupiter or whatever.
Yeah.
And just like the clouds coming off, like this visually, like I said, it was just different. And I'm sure someone's done something similar to it in the past, but I don't think they've done it as well, or I haven't seen it yet. So, it, like I said, visually, even when the story itself bogged down with this or that, the visuals kept me interested. Mm-hmm. So it was a fun movie to watch.
Yeah. One of my good friends is she's studying costume design, and, she tweeted yesterday about the costumes and the set decoration for Jupiter Ascending, saying she might see it just because of that. She had a couple of pictures included of some of the costumes and stuff in real life and the set in real life or whatever. Really cool, though. You can see all the detail a whole lot better in these mm-hmm. in these pictures. There's always something good to look at, you know, in the movie. You could always find something cool to look at. Yeah. Josh, are you Joshua KC3 on Twitter? Is that you? What's your Twitter handle?
My Twitter. Hey, wait a minute. We haven't gotten to the last section yet.
Well, I'm gonna retweet this. And I'm gonna tag y'all so y'all can see these pictures. But
No. My Twitter handle is Hey, it's that Josh.
Okay. Cool.
Ooh, well, I get to say it twice.
I know.
Yeah.
So if you missed it, well, and then what they say, like, you're supposed to repeat like a phone number like three times somewhere in your message, like it's like the rule of threes or something like that.
Yeah, it's like every sales manual is also like you should repeat somebody's name a bunch of times so that you can remember their name for later or mm-hmm. something. Mm-hmm. So yeah,
it makes them feel good about themselves too.
It really does. Well, it helps me a lot because I can't remember people's names for the life of me. I'm still I'm not confident even if I know someone's name. Sometimes I'll just lose all my confidence that I've got their name right.
No, I'm deathly afraid because apparently almost everyone who ever guests on the show is named Josh or nice. John, and so I'm always like, it's Josh, right? Can there really be this many people named Josh or Elijah? We have so many Elijahs now. What's going on?
Yeah, what's the deal with that?
What is up with that? Speaking of Elijah, so anything else you want to add, man, in closing?
About Jupiter Ascending?
Yeah, mostly.
Everyone should watch Speed Racer.
Everyone should what?
Everyone should watch Speed Racer.
Everyone should watch Speed Racer. It's so good.
Just be aware that in the middle of the movie, there's this long diatribe against capitalism. Actually, that's what I'd like to add about this or whatever.
Go Speed Racer.
I think people write off the Wachowskis film before they see them because how much they cost. It's mm-hmm. that pattern in Hollywood and film criticism, whatever, to write off movies because they're expensive and ambitious before they even see them. And then don't even like really watch them because I've already written them off. And I think the Wachowskis are very aware of this, coming from the Matrix sequels on, that happens to them every single time. And I think that's one of the reasons they hate capitalism so much, because everything is just valued based on how much money it is worth or makes. And so they always have this little anti-capitalistic thing going on in their films. That's super interesting to me. I feel bad for them, but I admire their anti-capitalist urges, I guess. Mm. Yeah.
Well, I definitely think that's another nugget for people to be able to chew on for a while. Josh, anything else that we didn't get a chance to talk about or you wanted to mention about the film?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is what I've been learning slowly about movies like this in general is that I think a lot of people, Elijah, kind of what you said, they immediately devalue a movie if it's expensive or flashy.
Yeah.
And or even if they go and see it, which a lot of people go and see it, you know, there's automatically a thread there that you have to figure out something to criticize this movie. And I really appreciated earlier this week on Real World Theology, I shared one of the articles that Real Spirituality has as kind of like their set of articles about how to approach a movie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Garrett's and not article. To, yeah, 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 Gareth's article about, you know, not being hesitating and being a critic and being an explorer. And I think that's really been shaping how I've gone to these movies. And I think I enjoy movies a lot more when I stop trying to make fun of them
yeah.
or find something that's really critical about it. The movie is so much more enjoyable when you're able to just find the good and the true and the beautiful in a movie and not focus on the negative. And I've been remunerating a lot on Paul, the Apostle Paul's charge in Philippians 4:8, you know, to whatever is true, whatever is good, you know, I'm not quoting it exactly here, but mm-hmm. think about those things. And a lot of people have used that as sort of like this filter with movies in general. And I'm speaking purely from a Christian perspective. I don't expect, you know, critics in like, you know, a newspaper, yeah. like the Times or the Tribune or whatever to use this as their filter. But a lot of people, especially Christians, are using this passage to sort of be like, well, it doesn't have anything good or true or beautiful that I can see. And it's definitely not honoring God. So I don't want to watch this movie, or I'm just going to pan it. Or, you know, I'm going to be like, it's a scheme of the enemy. You know, yeah. that's what this movie is. And that is not what that passage is supposed to be used for.
yeah.
It's supposed yeah. to be used to find like the truth and the beauty and God's truth and God's beauty and just the good things about a movie. And so like, you know, I think I learned this from my absolute like fanboy takedown of The Hobbit from last year. And I've really like learned from that and just like how that has attracted a lot of negative attention. And because people are attracted to that sort of negative attention.
Oh, yeah. Hey, it gets clicks, you know?
Yeah, it's like the Russian newspaper that did this experiment where for one day they decided to only publish things that were positive and their readership dropped by 2/3. And
yeah.
So, but I think that we as just, you know, moviegoers in general, what we can do is we can find more of the positive things in a movie and the things that, you know, point us to what's true and what's good and what's beautiful. Even if we don't necessarily agree with those things, we can at least engage it. And with a movie like Jupiter Ascending, which has a lot of problems, there's a yeah. lot of really, really fun and great things about this movie. And the Wachowskis have something to say, and they do it well, and they do it in a fun way. And why don't you want your movie to be like that? mm-hmm. You know, to be fun. And, you know, I think that a lot of people have gone to the other end since, like, The Dark Knight came out. And they're like, if it's not super serious and it doesn't go really super deep in a way that I like, then I'm just going to crap all over the movie. Mm-hmm. And that I've been finding out there's a lot of people that just want to take a real big dump on Jupiter Ascending. And I just don't think that we need to. It was fun
yeah.
and it was great. And if you've seen it, you probably know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
So there's no, go ahead, Elijah.
I was going to say, I'm glad you found that article somehow. I love that article that Gareth wrote. Stop criticizing, start exploring is what we called it. Because I think you're right. There is this. Oh, what is the right word for it? Just mean edge to a lot of what passes for film criticism and cultural criticism, especially online. It's all online these days, and it's just a shame because you miss out on a lot of really good stuff. And I mean, honestly, I would say that Christians are often more guilty of it than non-Christians are. Like you said, we use that passage as a Cate Blanchett to just trash stuff. You know, it's like, well, I've decided it's not good and beautiful, so I can say whatever I want about it. You know,
right?
And that's just, it's just really sad. Yeah. So, just out of curiosity, just because I run our website, how did you find that article?
I think I was just poking around on the site, and I was looking for, and I think you had a link to like two articles that you typically use with your
The Practicing Critics Program.
Yes, that's it. There?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and I was like, I think I just saw that practicing critic thing, mm-hmm. and I clicked on it, and I was like, I wonder what this is, and then it had those two articles, and I've. The article by you from 2013 and then Garris from 2012. And they were both really, really helpful in being able to understand that. Cause I've been thinking a lot about it. You know, like I said, ever since I did, a very, very negative review of The Hobbit. Mm. And part of that was just because like, I'm a huge fan of The Hobbit. And so I didn't appreciate the way that Jackson decided to end it. Mm-hmm. And you know, I learned from that a lot of people read it or like responded to the negativity, but I didn't feel really that great about it.
Yeah.
And I've been trying to figure out for a long time, like why that was, why did I feel so, why even though I smashed out over 1,000 characters and, you know, or 1,000 words, I should say. And, got a lot of people talking about it. Like, why didn't I feel that great about it? And I think it was because of that. Cause I was coming from it. Like the movie frustrated me and I was unwilling at some point to care about what might've been good or great about it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's been forming a lot of my opinion. And I just been doing a lot of stuff too, that I'll get to when we're signing off here, where that was just a really helpful article in sort of shaping how I was looking at a lot of movies and how I'm going to discuss them with people. So
good. That's good to hear. Good.
Yeah. It's good to see, like growth in your own work and then like that self realization, because for a second I thought, based on your kind of lampooning of The Hobbit, when you said that, everyone wanted to kind of crap on this film for a second, I thought you said everyone wanted to crab on it. Because you were so known for your, you know, your takedowns of films that everyone just started coining the crab.
I hope not.
Well, okay, and so I'll say this to it too, and this is one of the things that I wanted to say, and kind of like my final thoughts. Like, again, I really enjoyed this film. I was very entertained by it, and what I found is kind of going into the world and evangelizing this concept of like entertainment is not mindless. People will often say, well, I don't want to do that. I don't want to think about my movies. I just want to be entertained by them and go home. And I try to fight that, but I realize that there's also people on the other side, especially with critics. And I found myself doing this from time to time, knowing that entertainment shouldn't be mindless, especially I think to Christians. They say that, or they take it a step further and say that because entertainment is not mindless, entertainment cannot be fun. It's got to be a job or it's got to be work. And I also basically reject that as well, because I think this movie is an amazing example where you can go. And the main point of this movie to me, why I would recommend people watching it and why I will probably end up watching it again someday, is because it's fun. And I'm perfectly fine with movies' primary point being fun. That doesn't mean we can't talk about it. It doesn't mean we can't have an intelligent discussion about it. It also doesn't mean that it's not worthwhile, because what we mainly got from it was enjoyment. But let's talk about that enjoyment. Let's talk about, still, there's always something there. So I don't want people to walk away from a film like this like I said, especially as a critic, and be like, you've got to be in this camp or this camp. Like, there's no in between. I'm hoping that what we aim for, especially on this show, is the in between. The realizing that you can enjoy a film, be entertained by it. It is entertainment. But yet also take a second to be like, what did I just consume? What is it saying to me? And hopefully use that as a springboard to have great conversations in your communities or your families, anything like that. Because, you know, as you said earlier, Josh, you know, we need to be mindful of, you know, what we dwell on. And I think that's a really great point. And so, like I said, final thought is this movie's fun, and that's okay. So, I really appreciate you guys, you know, diving in, tackling the movie with me. It's been a lot of fun, and I think that's okay. So Elijah, how can people find the work that you do and follow you or continue discussions with you?
Yeah, well, I work for Real Spirituality at Fuller Seminary. So realspirituality.com is where everything gets posted. And then on Twitter, I am at Elijah Davidson. If you want to follow just Real Spirituality, it's at Real Tweets, R-E-E-L, Tweets. So.
Cool. Josh?
Should I say it twice? Was that the way
it was? No, you're supposed to say it three times. So you say it now.
Three times.
You work it in a little bit later, and then when we sign off, you're like, Real Tweets.
Nice.
Okay,
nice.
Gotcha.
Cool. Yeah, well, you can find most of the written work that I do at Real World Theology website. You can go there, check it out. It's great. So, you know, we've got articles four times a week and movie reviews as well. So that is pretty awesome. You can connect with me on more movie stuff on the Facebook for Movie Lovers, Letterboxd, where I'm checking on stuff all the time and bragging about what movie I just saw. So you can check me out there. Please go on there. There's always more fun to be had on Letterboxd, so be on Letterboxd. My Twitter handle is Hey It's That Josh. And you can talk to me on the Twitter. And the last thing is something new and fun is here in Appleton, Wisconsin. I'm a pastor at Appleton Gospel, and I have a friend who is a church planter at Emmaus Road Church here in town. And we're putting on a monthly movie discussion night at the coffee shop Brood Awakenings. And so we've kind of got that mutual project working on between us that we're calling Think About These Things, which is, you know, the end of that Philippians 4:8 passage I was talking about. And nice. We're going to be screening a movie and talking about it afterwards. So you can find out more about that on Facebook. We have the Facebook page, Think About These Things. And the first movie we'll be watching, for anybody listening, of any of my friends who won't hear about it from me, which will hopefully be zero. You can, we're going to be watching the movie Whiplash and talking about it afterwards on, I believe, March 20th, which is a Friday. And that's a day before I venture to just down the street from there to the Wildwood Film Festival, which is a local Wisconsin film festival for Wisconsin-based talent. Mm-hmm. And I'll be going to that as well. So, which I'm very excited about. So it's going to be my first ever film festival, and it's going to be the local one just down the street from here. So, anyways, you can go to that Facebook page and find out a little bit more about what we're doing. It's not completely finished yet, but by the time this airs, hopefully it'll be finished.
Well, you can follow me at Physification on Twitter. You can follow the show at Real World Theo. And if you'd like to know more about Real World Theology, then visit our website at realworldtheology.com. That's R-E-E-L, worldtheology.com. And again, for a third time, that's realworldtheology.com. Connect with us on Facebook and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. And if you enjoy it, review the show, leave us some feedback, tell your friends, and let's get more people involved in these awesome conversations. So, thank you so much for, you know, being here, guys. It's been great. If there was a time where you wanted to repeat your Twitter handle for the second time, this would be a great opportunity. Nope.
Did I mention that my Twitter handle is Hey, it's that Josh?
Yeah, I'm at Elijah Davidson.
So thanks so much for the, actually it's a morning discussion, which won't matter to the listeners because they probably won't know, but it's always interesting. We usually record in the evening. Morning discussions are always fun. And speaking of the listeners, thank you so much for taking time to make us a part of your week. And until next episode, remember that story is powerful and entertainment is not mindless, but it can be fun. Bye-bye.
That's Hey, It's That Josh on Twitter. Bye. And I'm on Letterboxd.
Sean Bean is part B.
This podcast is a member of the Crossover Nexus. To find out more or to hear about other podcasts that engage faith and pop culture, please go to www.crossovernexus.com.
Like, never try something new on the podcast, like during podcast time.
Okay, do you hear anything now?
I don't. I'm okay, except good. For your children.
I think, dang it. Yeah, sorry, they're really loud.
Oh.
I'm trying to kill the, and this is like.
Not the children, right?
What? Kill the children?